Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I'm talking to Richard Lingerman, distinguished veteran of the nation, about an interesting part of the nation with a small N's history, Noir 40s, and I have to say that reading Richard's book has given a sort of whole new light to how the greatest generation actually performed on their return in 1945 and 1946. So, Richard, how did you, first of all, get into the idea of writing about the subject, and then how did you decide to sort of pair it with the cinematic history of the period?
Well, it was goes without saying. I was old enough to remember that period, though I was a young kid and growing up during World War II and then after the war. But I felt that was a very crucial period, and I'm beginning to look at it. A lot of things were happening. A lot of choices were made. A lot of roads were taken that led us from the peace, which everybody was overjoyed to greet at the end of World War II, and then 5 years later we were at war in Korea. And by then I was in college, and so everybody at my age faced the draft. They had a draft in those days, a peacetime draft, but then until then the war came, so it was a wartime draft. But anyway, that affected my life, so I wanted to look into the causal links and what was going on and how this period came about. So it was very important to me and important in my life. I was trying to frame myself in my times. I think it's important that we do that. Anyway, that was sort of my motivation, and I just pursued it from there and went researching into it, into the period. And it was a fascinating period, I think, the things that happened then, crucial period. And the films noir are important to this era because that was their heyday, exactly the years 1945 to 1950. Film noirs were, as your listeners probably know, are crime films. They have a sort of a dark, fatalistic look at things. They're not mystery stories in the traditional sense. They're stories about crime. You know who did it usually, and it's the psychology of the criminal becomes important in the milieu. But it seemed to me they reflected the times. They gave me a psychological insight into the times, or looking at it another way, why were they so popular then? Why after the war? It came to me when I started reading up on some of these films that they really started in 1944 during the war, which was 44 was the year of the highest number of deaths among American combat troops. Of course, it was the invasion of Normandy and the fighting in the Pacific, and it was a bloody year, and I think the war seeped into our consciousness and the violence and death. And so there began appearing a group of films starting with, you could say sort of arbitrarily, Double Indemnity, a Billy Wilder film starring Barbara Stanwyck. And it was about Fred McMurray, and it was about a couple who have an illicit affair, and then they plan to murder her husband. So but it was sort of a new kind of murder, and it was noticed by the reporters who covered the movies, and they started calling these films red meat films, meaning that there was a lot of killing in them, and are even a sort of a cold attitude towards murder. And I think this came out of the war, and that's certainly what the reviewers at the time felt, and they felt this was a definite trend. So anyway, these films kept coming out, and they enjoyed a vogue, and eventually the French, who had been embargoed on American films during the Nazi occupation, they were suddenly exposed to a whole flood of American movies, and the French critics in 45 and 46, and they were looking at all these films, they said, there's something different about Hollywood films. They're more pessimistic films. They're not these cheerful, happy-ending films so much anymore. I mean, they're still coming out, but they notice these new crime films. And they immediately said they have to do often with death. And they were dark films. So the French term, of course, is noir. Black films. They have black novels, a series noir of crime novels. Well, they saw all these films as film noir, so they acquired a much fancier name than originally, and so that's how they were noticed not only here but over there that this trend was going on. And so I thought this provided an insight into the darker side of the times when people were, oh, you know, getting over the war and the losses of their sons in some cases, their fathers or brothers, and people were trying to get their lives back together. It was a time also of great uncertainty. That's a key word. People who were working in war plants, for example. Millions had gone to work in the war plants during the war to make the munitions that were badly needed in the fighting. And so after the war, they worried about the jobs, and they were making good money, and they were making overtime. And so the unionized workers wanted to guarantee the continuance of these gains, wartime gains they had made. So there was a great wave of strikes, and at the same time, the psychology, according to the polls, was people didn't know what was going to happen with the economy after this wartime stimulus was removed. So they feared that they would go right back to the Depression days during the 30s. The Great Depression put so many out of work, and then the war came and stimulated industry, of course, and it really ended the Depression. But now people were saying, what next? And we're on the cusp of a new world, a new post-war world. What's going to happen?
Well, that's one of the points. Looking, you know, I've read the history of the era, but it's the vignettes you include, that the whole idea of macabre troop ships coming in from Europe and the Pacific filled with corpses, the repatriation of the bodies, which is a uniquely American thing. You know, the British policy has always been to bury, you know, near the battlefield or wherever it happened. But the idea of repatriating the bodies was a sort of continual macabre reminder to everybody of their losses, wasn't it?
Yes, it certainly was. You're right, because the policy was to bring home all the dead if the loved ones or relatives wanted them brought back. Otherwise, they would be buried in these military cemeteries abroad, which were quite beautiful places. But anyway, it was a choice of the next of kin. And so a lot of the boys were exhumed that had been killed over there, and that, you know, they were buried everywhere. And in the Pacific campaign, they were fighting on these islands rather than on a great landmass like Europe. So So they were buried in these coral reefs, and then some were buried in mass graves. Anyway, they went and dug them up, and they tried to repatriate everyone. And there was a great scene which I describe in my book, and when the troop ships brought the first wave of bodies back to New York City, and the whole city was almost in mourning, and then they had a parade up Broadway, and then a memorial service in Central Park, and everyone was teary-eyed and sad, and so it still affected people even after the war.
Well, you know, they say that comparisons are odious, but there's lots of comparisons, not just on this, of course. The Bush administration was smuggling the corpses of the remains of the veterans of the casualties from Iraq under cover of darkness at Dover Air Force Base, if you remember, obviously to avoid precisely those scenes. But what I found fascinating reading your book was looking back at things through. We tend to look back at this through the prism of accepted history afterwards. So, you know, the social tensions, the strikes, aren't really part of the popular consciousness of the return of the greatest generation. But what really does strike home is the parallels of a vacillating Truman trying to fight off the conservative anti-New Dealers, the diehard Republican and Southern Democrats. It has uncanny echoes, you might say.
Well, it certainly does. I mean, it's almost exactly the same, that a group of conservative Republicans who had been sort of held down during the war. Well, actually, they were pretty active during the war, but the war effort was going on. But once it was over, they sort of sparked by a lot of large industries and businesses who wanted to get the government off their backs, wanted lower taxes and less regulation, and wanted to be free to profit in the post-war economy. They wanted to reverse the New Deal, really, to repeal it. And and Truman, of course, he was a New Dealer. He was, a man placed in a very big job with little preparation by the sudden death of Roosevelt, and who was, a towering figure at the time. And he was gone, and so Truman stepped in, and people wanted him to succeed, but they gradually lost confidence in him.
You mentioned he started off with an 87% approval rate, which is sort of almost Albanian dictator style, isn't it?
That's right, yes. It just shows a burst of goodwill. And by, if you want to leap forward, by 1951, after the first winter of the Korean War, it was down to 30%. Because this war was going so badly, so that's another story. But anyway, his popularity dipped.
To what extent do you think the Korean War sort of was responsible for? Obviously, you show that there were U-turns even before, with huge business lobbies campaigning against price controls and to keep wages down and against the unions, but certainly in Britain, the Korean War put a big line under the post-war Labour government's attempts to build the welfare state, because the precarious finances of what was left of the British Empire just couldn't stand the cost of the Korean War and to expand the welfare state beyond what they'd already done. And to what extent was it the watershed for what you might call sort of mainstream progressive politics in the U.S.?
Well, I think it had a similar effect. We weren't as far left in America, but Truman had a whole 21-point program for expanding the New Deal, including things like government finance medical care for everyone, and a lot of these ideals that we are still for and that are finally realizing. But at that time, when the war came and he took us into the war, it stopped all reform. What it started as I show in one chapter, is there was a among the foreign policy and defense establishment in Washington a great desire to increase defense spending. After the war, defense spending had been cut off. People said, the war's over, bring the boys home, we don't want to spend anymore. But then the policy brain, starting with Dean Acheson, who became Secretary of State, and James Forrestal, who was the Secretary of Defense, they said, the American people are getting soft and lazy, and we've got to scare them into realizing that the Soviets are a menace and we should rearm the country. And so there was a lot of war scare talk going on in 48, even before the Korean War.
But you mentioned even before the Korean War as well that there were astute business lobbyists who were in effect invented the concept of a permanent war economy. So they denied sort of Keynes in terms of spending to boost business on civilian infrastructure, but thought if you basically continued the war by other means without the actual fighting, you could keep business booming for the duration.
Yes, they were. That was definitely a consideration among Charles Wilson, the head of GE. He posited that point. He said, even before the war is over, we've got to start a permanent war economy, a permanent preparedness economy. And it was in the interest of business, of course, because war contracts had become sort of a steady flow of cash. Business was anxious. The aircraft industry in California just boomed in the war, but then after the war, there was no military orders, and civilian orders were slow in coming, so it almost died out. But along came the Korean War, and as Dean Acheson said, this made it possible for us to rearm, because now we were actually in a war, And so defense spending, understandably, went up, and it doubled or tripled in the first year of the Korean War, and a lot of it was going towards long-term things like building aircraft. And so it revived, you could say, putting it oversimplified, is the military-industrial complex. The military-industrial complex.
As identified by Republican President Ike, Dwight Eisenhower.
Yeah, right. He did recognize its existence at the end. But that's everything was booming, and that started that trend of spending on the military that Eisenhower warned against, and that has continued to the present day. I mean, there was a time, we've forgotten, when military spending was very low, and so this the Korean War started that, and I believe that the Korean War was to jump ahead. It was a precedent for future interventions, such as in Vietnam, and it was done on under President Truman, under his powers as Commander-in-Chief. Congress was not brought into the decision, and I think that was a mistake. And we can, you know, argue about the whole thing about the war, but it started this trend that we've got to take a stand. We've got to not look weak, or the communists will make gains, and this psychology has started at this time with the Korean War.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I'm talking to Richard Lingerman about his new book, The 40s Noir, The Noir 40s. I put them in the French order just to be correct. one of the contrasts here, of course, is that in the 40s, we almost have a real-time economic experiment. We had extremely strong unions. We still had a lot of government interference in the economy to try to direct it. We had rising wages. We had a GI Bill guaranteeing education for the returning veterans and very low military expenditure, but we actually had an expanding economy, an expanding lifestyle. So you could say, in real terms, this is a crucial experiment compared with the current abysmally failed one of cutting back expenditure, cutting back on government, and then wondering why everything goes pear-shaped on the indicators.
Well, it's certainly true. It was a time, you know, I don't know how much the analogy works, but it was certainly a time of prosperity, and because there was a great pent-up civilian demand, and also we in an international trade, you talk about the British Empire going, you know, drying up, and the U.S. sort of took over internationally as being the one country that was not devastated by the war. So on two fronts, the U.S. economy was ready to boom, and it gradually did, and all these fears about a depression, which were very real in 1946, were pretty much gone by the 1950s. But it's true, that was when the unions were strong and government assistance to the economy in a lot of forms that some stemmed from the war. Businesses were given a lot of new plants were built during the war, and they were given a cushion, a financial cushion after the war that they could draw on, making the reconversion to peace. And they hadn't made a lot of profits during the war from defense. So anyway, the industry was poised to really go, and that's what happened.
They went.
As they said in the song of the times, and let the good times roll, and eventually they did.
But you're also one of the things that doesn't seem to change is the dog whistle politics as well. All of these Southern Democrats and Republicans who opposed unemployment benefits for returning veterans on the grounds that black returning veterans would also get them. The racist subtext for, you know, trying to stop spending on education, public spending on education, because it would benefit the wrong people. The echoes are still there, so potent, and you know, you think 70 years on, you might have thought for a little more progress. You know, having a black president is a big step forward, but all of that infrastructure of dog whistle Ku Klux Klanism is still hovering around there.
Well, it's hard to get to purge these old attitudes. Back then, of course, the Southern Democrats were Democrats. Now they're Republicans, but the Southern Dixiecrats in those days were very much in favor of segregation, and so they were part of the Democratic coalition, and Truman had to deal with them. But they certainly opposed any measures that would help black people and might give them ideas and make them start thinking about becoming more politically active, which they did, because it's partly the war. This another product of the war was the fact that a lot of black soldiers served, and they were fighting for democracy. They were fighting against fascism. Dare I say that word? Yes, fascism was racism, really, and only in a European guise. And so they came home, and their lynchings were still going on, and there was discrimination and all. So some of these soldiers, ex-soldiers now, who had been treated badly even back in the States, they said, this has got to stop. And they started getting agitating for equal rights. It took some time, but this is when it started. When some of the first freedom rides were held during the late 40s, there was just a stirring of what would become the civil rights movement, and black veterans could get an education, and they could go to where their colleges were segregated in the South, so they had to go to a black college in the South. But in the, up north, they could go to college on the GI Bill, and they could get an education. A lot of them moved north, and so a lot of change there racially, a lot of pressure for change.
Well, the other part that's strikes me as more of the same, it's a deja vu all over again, is the ability of the lobbyists and the sort of, in fact, I think the Koch brothers and the DuPonts were sort of still were around to some extent, weren't they? The way that they persuaded the electorate to vote against their own interests, you know, for example, they reversed the whole trend about government quote interference unquote in the economy. Within a few months of an advertising blitz, I think you mentioned.
Yes, there were several business organizations, especially active. They were the traditional organizations then, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers especially. They're business lobbies, though, and they've concentrated in Washington, and they spent a lot of money from, which was, of course, donated by the big corporations, on advertising against government and the fear of socialism. There was a fear that we'd go like England and become socialistic too. And one of the methods that was used in these campaigns was to attack anything that was sort of pro-New Deal or liberal or left as communist, and communism became the scare word. And of course, by then, looming on the horizon was the Soviet Union, which was moving in very crudely into Eastern Europe and taking over.
Which tended to put the truth in the rumors about the threat of communism whenever it could.
Yeah, well, it was communism became a sort of a multi. Faceted evil.
A bit like drugs and terrorism, really, I suppose.
Yeah, it was. And it was very useful to use politically, whatever you may say of the international situation. But politically, it was good for the Republicans, especially. So it forced the Democrats to become aware of, say, there was a lot of spy rings exposed, and so then there's this panicky fear of espionage. So that meant that they had to impose this loyalty security program that Republicans were demanding at all.
Which, by the way, has antecedents going back to the Revolutionary War. The American loyalists had to sign loyalty oaths to the new state and make public declarations. There's a great historical tradition here. Richard, I'm afraid that's all we have time for. It's been fascinating. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I've been talking to Richard Lingerman about the Noir 40s, his new book, and about an era that has helped shape a lot of what we see around us today. Thanks very much, Richard.
Thank you, Ian. I enjoyed it.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.